Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, a violent Memorial Day weekend in Chicago. Several killed, nearly 50 shot. What in the world is happening in a city? This happens over and over and over. We'll talk to Pastor Corey Brooks about that. Could the economy have an impact? The reality is there's a huge disparity when it comes to African Americans in Chicago having jobs compared to that of whites. Could that be a reason for the violence in the Windy City? We'll talk to the author of that study. Mayor of Newark, Roz Baraka, is talking about bringing the best black thinkers together to deal with some of the most pressing issues facing black America. He'll join us right here on News One Now. Basketball is certainly a significant sport in the black community, but could it be considered a religion? I'll talk with an author who explores the spiritual side of basketball in the hood. Time to bring the funk on News One Now, TV One.
As we've said before, it's about 1,500 people that we know are really driving the violence. Those are the people we're trying to concentrate on.
More violence in Chicago after a deadly Memorial Day weekend. Folks, there were dozens of shootings in the city, including several folks. Nearly 60 people suffered gunshot wounds since Friday. Five of those folks died. A 15-year-old girl was among those killed. She was a passenger in a car while riding with a suspected gang member. The number of shootings over the weekend is disappointing for the city, also for its police officers who patrol the streets in an effort to curb the violence. Last year, 14 folks were killed in a total of 46 shootings on Memorial Day weekend. It's amazing how in Chicago you could say that this year was better. The number of people who were killed went from 14 to 5, but the actual wounded went up 46 to 54. Chicago Tribune said there's been 1,400 shooting victims so far this year. Joining me right now via FaceTime from Chicago, Pastor Corey Brooks, head of New Beginnings Church of Chicago. Of course, he and others have been trying to tackle the violence in the city. Corey, again, we hear, first of all, a lot of people talk about the fact that in Chicago, cops are not happy with what is taking place after the Laquan McDonald shooting. Do you believe police are doing enough to hit the streets to go after those who are committing the crimes in Chicago?
I do believe we got a strong police force that's doing the very best they can do at this time. There may have been initially some back off from the police with the Laquan McDonald case, but I do believe that over time, especially with the appointment of a new African-American superintendent, that they've been going forward and doing the things that they're supposed to do. I think the biggest problem that we're having in our community is a problem with ourselves and trying to get everything situated and everything under control. And that's been the difficulty here in Chicago that we're experiencing.
I've talked to several other pastors who've actually met with gang members and first of all, gang leaders. What they said is many of these gang leaders say, look, this isn't the old days where we knew exactly who was doing what on the streets. You've got lone wolves, you got folks doing whatever. And so even gang leaders say they really cannot necessarily control what's happening on the streets.
Yeah, unlike the old days when there was some order to the gang banging, these days you have a lot of cliques, a lot of factions who are doing their own thing. A lot of young guys who are out of control, who are damaging our community and doing a lot of harm to our community, and no one can tell them what to do. One of the things that I've been very interested in, though, is that the police seem to have this statistic or thing that they put together to try to determine who's more likely to commit the murders or be murdered. And they have this hot list of about 400. And my thing has been, if you have a hot list of about 400 people, why not try to pursue them and give them some options other than murdering and going to jail? Why not meet with those 400 people and try to get them to do other things?
Arne Duncan is working with an initiative there tied with the Emerson Collective in Execute America out of San Francisco. And that's all about providing jobs for those folks who desperately need it. Is that also a critical component of this conversation?
Yeah, you know, one of the ways to stop a gangbanger, one of the ways to stop a murder or a bullet is to give a young brother a job. I think what we're experiencing here in the city of Chicago is a lot of young African-American males who are undereducated and unemployed. And when you have that combination together, uneducated and unemployed, you're going to have some tough times. And that's what we're experiencing. So if we can figure out ways to get these young brothers some training, get them some jobs, get them some alternatives, I think it will curb the violence a whole lot.
Last year, we talked about the need to have 10,000 men, black men, Christian men, hit the streets. Yes. What is the plan for 2016?
We're going to do the same thing. Yesterday, I spent my whole day out on the streets. And as soon as I started at 6 a.m. in the morning, I got out of my car. As soon as I got out of my car, around the corner from where I got out of the car and started praying, a shooting happened. And I filmed it, put it on Facebook and everything. That's the type of situation we're dealing with. We're dealing with situations on every corner. And we need to get all the brothers that we can, all the churches that we can, all the pastors to come out of the four walls of their church and get out in these streets where the real ministry is, because most of the work that Jesus did anyway, it was not in the four walls, it was on the outside. And so we can get the churches outside, the pastors outside, and make some communications and connections with these young brothers, I'm sure we can win some of them.
All right, Pastor Corey Brooks, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Roland. I appreciate it, as always.
Want to go to our panel, Mo Elathy, Executive Director for Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, Carmen Berkeley, AFL-CIO's Civil, Human, and Women's Rights Director, Dr. Chris Metzler, Political Scientist and President and CEO for FHW FIT. Folks, you heard that conversation. Again, what jumps out is we hear this over and over and over again. They really don't have any idea how to stop this from happening.
Well, I think that there are a lot of ideas to stop it from happening, and I think it actually goes back to funding. You know, one of the things that the pastor talked about is we have to figure this out. Well, I actually think that there are a ton of cities, there are a ton of states that have figured out we need to have better education systems. We know that the Chicago has been fighting, the teachers union has been fighting for more funding for the schools. We need to make sure there are more apprenticeship programs, more access to jobs. So to me, I mean, you know, it's great that the pastors are talking to each other and they're going out into the community, but at the end of the day, it sounds like they're blaming the victims. I mean, at the end, if there are no jobs, if there is no other way for people to actually, you know, have a productive, be productive in society, then that's exactly what people are going to do on Memorial Day weekend.
Well, first of all, man, if you are those pastors and others, I mean, you do blame those who are committing the heinous crimes, because there are so many different cases where they're taking shots at different folks, missing, killing folks, the sister who's coming out of a Starbucks, and so many others. And so I think you can be highly critical of those who are committing the crimes, but also deal with the decades of poverty that takes place in Chicago.
Yeah, because I think a large part of the problem is, in fact, the question of poverty. Poverty, and I actually applaud the pastors for taking responsibility and help our community to take responsibility for improving the situation and doing something about it, not simply waiting for the government to come up with yet another out-of-date solution. So I applaud the pastors for doing that. And certainly it goes back to the fact that if you're going to kill someone, if you're going to be involved in gangs, if you're going to be involved in those kinds of things, there are consequences which are law enforcement consequences.
Mo?
I don't think we can escape that.
Yeah, there's no one size fits all here. And there's no, you can't put all the burden or all the blame or all the responsibility on one party. There is part policy, there is part government, there is part the business community, there is part community groups, and there is part the faith communities all need to be a part of this at the street level, at the community level. For me, I think one of the big challenges is Chicago is the biggest, most stark example of a problem that is happening all over the country. Our urban centers are in a state of decline in so many places, and it's only being talked about at the margins in our national political dialogue. And so I think there does need to be a little bit more emphasis at all levels, not just at the local level, but all the way up to the White House, to really dive deep and figure out what we can do to tackle some of these systemic problems.
Well, one of the things that again, when you talk about community, and this is where community folks are going to have to also accept, you have to have dragnets there. Mm-hmm. You literally have to set up situations where you have pop-up blockades that are stopping folks, checking for warrants, also checking for guns. Now, folks begin to say, well, you get other people who are called in. No, when I was in Fort Worth, they did that where they had rash shootings. And what they did was they would drop a dragnet on a particular area. They would put up blockades, and anybody who was coming into that particular area was stopped. We do it for DUIs, and what that did was that began to get guns off the streets. It began to put folks in check, and we can't, as African Americans, have it both ways.
Right.
We can't complain about crime and then say, do something, but then turn around and then get mad at a particular measure. To me, this is not stop and frisk. This is not a question of, well, I'm just going to stop Chris, I'm going to ignore Mo, and I might stop Carmen. No, what this is saying, anybody who comes through this particular area that we know is a high crime area or a probability for those kind of shootings, we're going to stop folks to ensure they're not carrying guns illegally, because that's part of the issue.
But Roland, I also feel like a part of the answer is not necessarily over-policing the community. To me, if we're going to add more law enforcement, then there has to be reconciliation between law enforcement and the community. That's why a lot of the gangs are...
How is this over-policing? How is it over-policing if I have X number of shootings mm-hmm. in a particular area,
right,
and you begin to say Friday night beginning at 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. until Sunday at 9 p.m., we're going to erect these dragnets. And the whole point is for a kid who's going to play basketball to be able to get there and actually play basketball.
Absolutely.
Versus somebody getting shot. Because when you got gang members who are rolling around, who are packing, the likelihood of them rolling around packing, knowing full well I might get stopped, goes down.
Right, and to me, you know, for the weekend, yes, there are things that we can do over these hotbed weekends, Memorial Day, Labor Day, you know, the 4th of July, but there's a larger problem here, which is that it's about poverty, it's about the jobs, it's about the education, and if we start to fix those things, yeah, we can deal with it for the hot weekends where everybody's outside drinking and at the pool, but what are we doing to help fix Chicago? Because BYP 100 has been talking about jobs, and now, again, 50 people had to die for us to go back to the conversation
about jobs. And what I'm saying is, you can do all of that. There are short-term solutions, there are mid-range solutions, there are long-term solutions. And when I hear from people who are living in Chatham, who are living in Inglewood, who are living in these various neighborhoods, they're saying, look, I just want to be able to go outside.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't see it as over policing. I see it as the opportunity for us to be able to reclaim our communities. I don't know that I agree with it being on the so-called hotbed weekends. To me, you can erect a DUI point or any kind of point at any time, and I don't see why this is any different from that. I don't think it's over-policing. I think it's protecting the community and allowing the community to grow and flourish as it should. That is, I think, part of the solution.
And absolutely, when it comes to Chicago police, having the relationships with communities
of
as
course.
Well and improving that. But again, to me, you can actually do both. Look, I grew up in Clinton Park in Houston, and there were relationships with our civic club, which my parents actually were co-founders, and also with police there as well. And I can tell you, when there was a rash of crime, we wanted to have a relationship with the cops. And we didn't say, hey, we don't want to see any police officers. We were saying, fix this problem and not just totally ignore it. But could the issue of unemployment be a major issue? There's a new study that says there's a huge disparity when it comes to race in Chicago. when it comes to employment. We'll talk to the author of that report coming up next. Also, the mayor of Newark fills us in on his meeting of the minds to tackle persistent problems in the black community. Folks, contract work is becoming more popular by the day. Find out how folks working a gig are living rather comfortably in retirement. 14 after the hour. News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
As we just discussed, employment is a huge issue in Chicago and is a huge disparity when it comes to blacks and whites. A new Brookings Institution study finds Chicago's racial employment gaps with young adults are among the widest in the nation. Take the employment rate for 20 to 24-year-olds. It's 47% for blacks, but Latinos are at 70% and 73% for whites. Among the 10 largest metro areas in the country, black employment rates across all ages are the lowest in Chicago. Also, according to the Chicago Urban League's National Urban League's 2016 State of Black America report, Chicago ranked 62nd out of 70 in unemployment equality, 65th out of 70 in income inequality. Joining us here in D.C. to discuss this on the authors of the Brookings Institution report, Martha Ross, also joining us via FaceTime from Chicago, president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League, Cherie Runner. This is interesting because, again, I spent 6 years in Chicago, and what a lot of people talk about, they talk about Rainbow Push being there, Reverend Jackson, Nation of Islam being there, Minister Farrakhan. You talk about the successes in Chicago, John Johnson, so many African Americans who are entrepreneurs. But Chicago is still, to this day, one of the most segregated cities in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Chicago has a tremendous number of assets, a strong economy and a strong middle class. But when you look at the stats on especially young African Americans, they are really struggling. Less than half of young African Americans aged 20 to 24 have a job. That's the rates for whites in the total are much, much higher.
And so when you talk about this huge gap, this 23-point gap between Latinos and nearly a 30-point gap with whites, I mean, that translates to money. That translates into a future. That translates into so many things. And to me, this is a direct impact on what's happening on the streets when it comes to violent crime. As John Bryant, founder of Operation Hope, says, he said, you can't show me a ride in the community with a credit score 700 or higher.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the segregation and the rates of concentrated poverty play out in all kinds of negative ways. And this low employment rate and these high rates of disconnection of young people who are not in school and not working are related to that.
Cherie, I want to go to you. It was interesting. When I was there, City College of Chicago did a study that talked about literally $1 billion over a decade had not gone to African Americans due to them being left out of the trade union in Chicago. So when you begin to look at a lot of those industries in the city, you see grandfathers and grandmothers, mothers and fathers, now sons and daughters, nieces and nephews, totally being locked out. And if you even go downtown Chicago, you don't have one black-owned restaurant downtown Chicago. For the longest, the city, if you were past 22nd Street, you weren't even included on any tourism maps in the city.
The indexes show one thing, that generational poverty and segregation have created the perfect storm in Chicago. We know that poor educational system, poor educational funding have created an inability for our youth to find jobs or be able to access those jobs. We know that, and this is why this is the way we have to attack it. But that's a long-term fix. We absolutely have to fix some things short-term as well, and dealing with the guns and the drugs and the underground economy, which is way more accessible than a good job in a career that is above board, that you get with when you have an education, is something completely different than what we are seeing right now.
So where do we start?
Well, I think the first thing we have to start with is to try and figure out how do we fix this, the lax gun laws, the lax ability for our kids to be going from school to prison. Our schools are not putting our kids in a place where they can access jobs and do the right things. So we have that's a short term. Then we have to deal with what do we do to make sure that all of our children are able to access opportunity in our economy. And that's a longer term and it's a bigger fix, and we know that's been going on for decades.
You mentioned about the lax gun laws. What specific gun laws are you talking about that's laxed?
Well, what we hear here in Chicago is that it is better for me to have a gun.
Actually, we lost her there. Martha, I want to go to you. Again, solutions. How do we get to that point? If we are looking at these numbers, when you talk about nearly 30% between blacks and whites and 23% between blacks and Latinos.
One of the striking facts is that as big as these disparities are by race, they are bigger by education. The disparities among those with an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree and those with less than a high school or a high school degree are much, much greater. So that points to education as a lever for change, which is more long term. But education doesn't only mean a 4-year college degree or a 2-year college degree. It means there's a lot of kinds of trainings and work experience through groups like Youth Build and the Service Corps that can help increase job readiness and skills.
I mean, to me, you know, I know how much you love unions, and I work for a union, but, you know, to me, I actually feel
I just need to hold them accountable.
I know.
I've called on those same unions.
Yeah, you have, and
I've called those same unions to tell those trade unions stop blocking black folks out of them.
Hey, look, I'm the civil rights director of the union, so I understand. I mean, but to me, in Chicago specifically, there is a Latino brother named Jorge Ramirez who has been working with the building trades to try to identify more ways for us to get black folks and Latinos into the apprenticeship programs in Chicago, because we all know this is a crisis. But I think the other thing is we need to be looking at policies that prevent people who are formerly incarcerated from getting into these jobs. Because right now, if you're formerly incarcerated, which there are a ton of people in Chicago who are, we have jobs where you automatically cannot apply to even be a part of the job if you have a record. So I agree. The labor movement actually does need to come together and figure out in these urban areas how do we provide more jobs, but we also have to turn over some policies too.
Mo, I don't want apprentice jobs. There are black folks in that city who are already trained. They simply can't get hired. So I want those jobs. Same thing I told Hillary Clinton when we were in Ohio at the presidential town hall. Go ahead.
Yeah, look, and I think part of the challenge here is, okay, so you're a young black person or a young Latino person and you get educated, you get those skills, you leave the community because the communities are struggling, right? And so you're finding this you're creating this cycle where the people who get the skills, who get the opportunity, leave. The people who don't, stay. And it's hard to attract. You need to bring these jobs into these communities. It's hard to attract those jobs into the communities if, you know, what business wants to relocate into a war zone? So we're creating this vicious cycle, and which comes first? Which comes first? We got to figure out a way to attack it from both ends.
Well, and also I think what you have there, Martha, you really have political leaders. And again, I as somebody who spent 6 years there, the politics is segregated, the economics is segregated, and the things that are allowed to happen on the south side and on the west side simply would never be allowed to happen on the north side of Chicago.
That's right. I mean, I spent not 6 years in Chicago, but enough time to drive up that State Street corridor and see those miles and miles of public housing and think, where is the economic opportunity here? Where are the stores? Where are the schools? And you think those environments need to change for these stats to improve.
All right, then. Again, so one of the things that, again, I know that Arne Duncan, former Secretary of Education, is doing with the Emerson Collective is to deal specifically with finding those jobs, offering incentives, and pairing them with young African Americans there. So we'll see what happens with that initiative as well. Martha, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Shereen, thanks a lot. We had some issues with her audio. Be sure to get her back on the show. Next up, the mayor of Newark, Roz Baraka, shares his focus on power politics at Community Reinvestment Summit that took place in Newark. We'll hear from him up next. Also, are you one of the folks who has a gig was also saying, you know what, I can still retire well, but we'll talk to Deborah Owens about that. Plus, we'll hear from the author of the book, Gods of the Asphalt, How Basketball is Sort of Like a Religion. Really interesting. Plus, Kenny Leon, Broadway director. I was in Atlanta for his Celebrity Gala and Golf Tournament. We also have that in our Rolling with Roland segment. All of that right here on News 1 Now TV 1.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now. With Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Folks, the mayor of Newark, Ros Baraka, held a summit in his city to deal with the issue of what's happening in the Black community. Brought together some of the best and brightest minds to discuss, again, solutions to transforming some of these inner cities all across the country. His summit will deal with poverty, the education gap, bolster technology, and also deal with criminal justice reform and explore the role of art in the community. He joins us right now. And so we're certainly glad to have him with us. Mayor Baraka, first and foremost, why do this? And for me, the most important thing is never the meeting. For me, is what's going to happen after the meeting. What's the plan of action?
Absolutely. The actual convention, if you will, conference is the 9th of June to the 12th of June, actually the 11th, upcoming. The idea is to have it right before the general election for the presidency, to begin bringing some of our finest minds together to begin talking about creating policy and ideas around solutions of how do you move this thing forward. It's not enough for us to just come out and vote in November or go at each other in the primaries. We actually have to have some type of policy, some type of plan of action to move any body who becomes the president of the United States around issues that are affecting our community in many of these cities across the country. It is very important for us to do that. It's very important for us to have real kind of dialogue, closed door discussion about these issues that have been you know, very difficult to overcome in our community for the last 5-6 decades. And I think we have to do, like you said, not just meeting for meeting's sake, but to begin to start talking about how do we push the agenda forward.
You talk about developing an urban Marshall Plan, dealing with the wealth gap, also supporting Black Lives Matter, other issues along those lines. Who have you invited? Will Black Republicans be there? Will you have entrepreneurs there? Will you have CEOs? Or are you mainly targeting social activists and political leaders?
Well, we have people from the entertainment world, like Talib Kweli. We have Mayor Kasim Reed. We have Jelani Cobb. We, you know, journalists. We have a plenty of different individuals, from economists to academics, that'll be there discussing these issues in a roundtable kind of discussion way, not like just a Q&A or the normal process, but a real roundtable to begin putting these issues on the table, to begin discussing how do we move an agenda forward, an agenda that we, you know, obviously have not had in a very long time. And yes, we do need an urban Marshall Plan. I think that's the key to it. I was listening to the show before this one, and I think the bottom line is we need an urban Marshall Plan. We need, you know, a work projects administration. We need a New Deal in these communities. The New Deal missed us. You know, when the New Deal was being created, the Democratic Party was in the middle of segregation, right? So it missed us completely, and we need serious investment in these neighborhoods and these cities.
Chris?
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, I didn't hear the answer to the question. Will you have Black Republicans there?
Oh, we actually invited everybody, you know, from, I don't think their political status mattered. We invited as many people as we could from, you know, all, you know, walks of life and ideas, and hopefully they come and be a part of this discussion.
Because I, you know, being that we have two candidates for office, I just want to make sure that, in fact, Black Republicans are part of that discussion because we don't know which way the election will go.
Yeah, but
one
reason I asked that question, I mean, not just I saw the names, is also because I've made this point. Look, you've got 31 Republican governors across the country. Yeah. You've got legislatures. I'll be in North Carolina on Wednesday dealing with the bill that could drastically impact HBCUs. And the reason I believe that should happen is because Black Republicans also, there's a level of accountability there as well.
Yes.
Because the reality is, whether you got a Democratic mayor or Republican mayor or a governor of either party, bottom line is we've got issues that need to be dealt with. And so we need to be holding everybody's feet to the fire.
Correct.
Absolutely. And you know what?
Well, I don't disagree. And I think local politics is a lot different than national politics. Locally, most mayors and governors have to figure out how to pick the snow up, how to collect the garbage, right, how to make schools work, how to reduce crime, how to deal with high levels of unemployment, double digit, particularly for African-American and Latino men. I mean, those are serious kind of issues. And I think that they really don't play into the kind of national kind of thing that's going back and forth. And to me, the discussion is not going to be about whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
Right.
It's about how are you servicing the people in our communities that are in desperate need and have been this way for 5 or 6 decades.
Carlin,
you have parts of the community that have no investment at all.
Carlin, Mo, real quick.
I mean, Mayor talked about uniting, mobilizing, and organizing the Black community, which is why bringing in Republicans is really important. We got to get past chicken dinners and articulate rhetoric speeches and get down to how are we going to change our community.
Mo.
I think over the past 20 to 30 years, the political power center in America has shifted away from the cities into the suburbs.
Yeah.
That is who candidates are talking to, are suburban voters. So the real question here is, this is a great meeting, but what happens next, and how do we get our urban sort of vote back up? How do we exercise that political power out of the cities to counterbalance that suburban move?
Mayor, I got 30 seconds. Go.
Well, the primary election is won by these cities. The GDP is here. The economy is trending back to America's cities, not the suburbs. We just have to make that clear. That's a fact. That's not an opinion or a chicken dinner speech. That's the reality.
Got it.
The reality is you can't be a Democratic nominee presidential without the urban vote, without Black people's votes, without Latinos' votes, without women's vote. That
Got
can't
it.
Happen anymore. It's a new party.
Newark Mayor Roz Morocco, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much. And we look forward to the 6-month follow-up after the summit. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thank you.
Up next, the author of Black Gods of the Asphalt talked about the intersection between basketball and religion. All of that on News 1 Now TV 1.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, folks, today's this full-time job, getting a watch, that's gone. Bottom line is people are far more transient in their jobs. And so America's Wealth Coach Deborah Owens is here to talk about how folks are transforming their gigs into a great retirement. So, Deborah, how's it going?
It's going great.
All right, so what are we looking at here? Because when you talk about freelancing, when you talk about people who literally are taking 3, 6, 9 month projects and sort of cobbling these things together, it's just a whole different world than the traditional job we're used to.
It is, and it's called the gig economy. I mean, you think of an Uber driver who is like on demand. You think of virtual assistants now. So many people are having to create that job for themselves, and the fact is they have limited benefits and limited access to any kind of retirement plan. So the key is you have to be able to make your own retirement or make your own 401k, if you would.
And when you think about that, because again, when we talk about these jobs, for a lot of people, they want the freedom and flexibility. They don't want to go into an office. They don't want to do the exact same thing. They want to be able to, frankly, work and then take a couple of months off and travel or do whatever. So it's a whole different mentality among today's worker.
It is a whole different mentality. Some by choice, some not. And many employers are even taking advantage of these on-demand jobs. You look at retailers, many of them have their workers, schedule their workers so that they only work when there are high traffic times. And so in this kind of dynamic economy, it's what I call the new financial normal, Roland. You have to be able to figure out
how you can create that plan for yourself. And so today I wanted to talk about those options for individuals who don't have access to a retirement plan, but know that they need to be saving for retirement.
And first of all, we saw in a 10-year period, 9.4 million folks have gone to the gig economy, if you will, which is a huge increase. And we talk about savings because at the end of the day, you could be working, you could be living, but you have to be putting money away. What is a regular IRA or Roth IRA?
So I wanted to start there today because depending upon how much money you're earning, if you're not making, let's say, in the six figures, and a lot of times people think they need a lot of money. So where you would start there is just with a regular IRA. And all a regular IRA allows you to do is to contribute a portion of what you're earning and deduct it. Now, as you can see, that contribution limit is quite low, $5,500. Mm-hmm. Now, some people feel like, oh my, I don't have that kind of cash flow to be able to do that when I do my taxes. So one of the things I encourage folks to do, you know, we say dream big but act small, is you can start with as little as $50. So the key is to start, to have something coming out of your, I tell self-employed people, a third for your expenses, a third for your taxes, and at least get 10, aim for that 10% to pay yourself first and to put toward a retirement plan.
Can a person do all three?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, because many of us have our work for an employer. We got a side gig. So any money that you have that is 1099 miscellaneous income could qualify for the SEP IRA. You know, the regular IRA, depending upon what your income is, you can still contribute to a regular IRA. It just depends on, like, if you're over $165,000 as a couple, you may not get to deduct those benefits and you may not qualify for it. But yes, you could do all three.
Well, see, Chris made too much money for all this, so, so he's like, you know.
He's eliminated.
He's like, whatever. What is a personal 401k? What is that?
It's a personal, I'm glad you asked that question, because a personal 401k is truly a 401k for a sole proprietor. So you can start a personal 401k if you're a solopreneur or your spouse is in that business as well. You can both put upwards to $53,000, even more so than you can contribute to a regular 401k. And so you can put that money away just like you would with a 401k. For many people, too, who are playing catch up as well, Roland, I really want to encourage them to look at all these mm-hmm. different options. Depending upon where your income stream is coming from will determine what kind of IRA would be appropriate for you.
All right. Groovy. More information, get it where?
At DeborahOwens.com/News1Now.
All right. We appreciate it. Thanks so much. Up next, Street Ball, Black Brothers in Religion, author of a new book, Black Gods of the Asphalt, says there is a connection. Yeah, really. It's next on News1Now TV1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
For many Black men, basketball is more than a game. It's a way of life. A new book claims basketball is even a religious experience for many Black men. The spiritual relationship between Black men and basketball, specifically street ball, is detailed in the new book, Black Gods of the Asphalt. I recently sat down with the author, Onaje Woodbine, to discuss the book, and I asked him if this was just an excuse for brothers not going to church.
No, not at all. In fact, in the beginning, basketball was connected to the church.
How?
James Naismith was the inventor of basketball. He was also a Presbyterian minister, and he invented the game in order to bring really white men into the church. And then the Black church picked it up as a stylized form of resistance to white supremacy.
So why do you call it a religion?
The reason why it is a religion, see, the stereotype is that Black men pursue basketball for economic reasons or racial reasons, having to do with poverty. But in fact, what's really going on, especially in the city, is that this game is a search for meaning. It expresses a search for meaning. They're asking questions like, who am I? What happens when you die? What is my purpose?
Oh, you getting all that out of playing basketball?
Yeah. You know, what I found in my interviews and observations was that Black men were going to the court really after somebody had died or been stabbed or shot, and they would experience the presence of this person on the court. And it became sort of this ritual space where they could grieve, where they could put sort of the streets in abeyance for a moment and experience some form of transcendence, or at least a search for meaning in this.
Now, how'd you arrive at all of this? Somebody watching sitting there going, he a professor of what?
Well, I grew up in inner city Roxbury in Boston, and my father wasn't around when I was younger, and my coach was my father figure, and he passed away when I was 12. And I went to the court to find him, you know, and I experienced his presence in that space, and I used it myself to grieve. So I knew, you know, I would always come back to the court later on.
You mentioned it's sort of a refuge.
Yes.
In a lot of communities, it's also the place that's off limits to what happens on the streets. So when it comes to the violence, when it comes to drugs, when it comes to all the beefs, it's sort of like, okay, within these lines,
yes,
it's all about the game.
No doubt. It's a pass. It really is. You know, so many young black men said, because I could play ball, because of that round ball, the gang members gave me a pass. It was like they thought I could do something more, I could be better. And so there was a certain amount of hope invested in ball players. It's almost as if ball players are sacred or set apart from the violence of everyday life in the streets.
So if you talk about black gods of the asphalt,
yes,
who would be one of the leading disciples?
One of the leading disciples, I think, would have to be someone like Pee Wee Kirkland, right? This is a ball player, famous ball player who grew up in New York and played ball and really was sort of a pioneer in street basketball. And I think a lot of the young men in Boston sort of follow in his footsteps. He ended up sort of foregoing an NBA contract and ended up in prison. But today, he speaks about basketball and he helps young men sort of realize their potential through basketball. And I think many of the young men that I interview sort of look up to him.
One of the things that also I think, because when you talk about hip hop and street basketball,
yeah,
and he was recently inducted to, well, first of all, inducted into the Hall of Fame, yeah, Allen Iverson.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
a lot of cats look at him differently than they do a Michael Jordan.
Yes.
A Magic Johnson.
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Because they can identify with him, especially young black men. He represents the street. He represents that hip hop culture. He represents that go hard or go home mentality. And, you know, in the streets, the gang members are around the court, you know, so the stakes are very high, right? Either you're playing ball or you're caught up in the streets. So if you don't bring it every day on the court, everyone is watching that. And so it's really a life and death. Either you have an identity as a ball player or you have to risk your life in the streets. And Allen Iverson really represents that, the sort of passion and fire, right, that these young men express on the court.
Well, it's also interesting when you think about individuals who you've never heard of, who never made to college, who never made to the NBA,
yeah,
but who had unbelievable game, and they are, in essence, black gods, I say small g god, when it comes to basketball.
Well, yeah. There are so many legends who you never heard of, but the streets keep sort of an oral history, an oral tab of them, because they've done things that are almost unimaginable on the court. And they represent this sort of symbol of possibility and hope in this community. You know, really, the game itself is like a living text. These are storytellers out there, and their bodies are expressing sort of their narratives and history, the narratives and history of the streets. And the hoop and the ball become a sort of vocabulary where, you know, I've seen many young men who say, I know somebody has gone through something difficult when they score 40, over 40, 50 points, right? When the ball goes in and they're just playing out of their mind, they're telling their story.
Who is one person out of all these cats who played street ball,
yeah,
that you would have loved to see play in the NBA?
Wow. I would have to say a young man that I talk about in my book, his name is Shorty, and he had a style that was just uncanny. I mean, you couldn't pigeonhole it. He would spin, the ball would be almost over his head, and he just moved so gracefully like an artist on the court. And I saw him when I was a young boy and saw him playing, and then 15 years later, when I was writing the book, I saw him on the court, and he had just got out of prison, and he couldn't look me in the eye. And I asked him what was going on. He said, you know, I'm here because I couldn't go to my grandmother's funeral. I couldn't go to my cousin's funeral because I was locked up. And this is the only place I know how to remember them. And he pointed to the back of his head and he said, this prison took something from me. And he didn't really have the words to say it, but it was almost like this internal injury and this sense of shame. And to see him go from being a god to that, you know, it really shook me. Really shook me. But he was one of my first interviews, and then I realized he talked about how important the space was to remember. I realized the court was a site of memory in this community and a place where young men were creating meaning.
The book is Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip Hop, and Street Basketball, on RJ XO Woodbine. We appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Roland.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, y'all. Y'all know Roland with Roland. I go to all these different golf events. You want to guarantee to get me to come somewhere, have a golf tournament. So I was recently in Atlanta for Tony Award-winning director Kenny Leon's Celebrity Golf Weekend to benefit True Colors Theater, helping out the young folks, of course, to deal with various educational programs such as the National August Wilson Monologue Competition for high school students. Here's a little of my conversation with Kenny Leon about that.
I want to thank everybody who's here this year, who's been here every year for us. This thing is for these kids that we take inner-city kids and we send them to New York City. Many of them never been on a plane before. Many of them never been in New York City. Last year we had Denzel Washington speak with them. It's about discovering themselves and knowing that America is for all of us. White, black, it doesn't matter.
You know, we ready. Y'all ready?
Good to stay ready. Keep them having to get ready.
Good morning, somebody.
I'll see you at the end.
Because he had the gala with my daughter.
Yes, what True Colors is about is getting the stupidity out the way so we can see the beauty in our children and see the beauty in our future and tell everybody's story.
Well, not only am I doing this to advance kids that want to go on Broadway, more importantly, I want to do this to make their dreams a reality, no matter what they think they want to do. Because one thing that August Wilson had 10 wonderful plays, but it's really 10 plays telling the same story. And the story is that America belongs to you. Even if your people came here in the bowels of a Dutch slave vessel, shackled and chained, whether your people came here seeking political freedom or religious freedom, however you got here, America belongs to you. It's yours. And we're not second or third class citizens. So what this program does is like, oh, many of our inner city kids haven't had the opportunity to fly on an airplane, haven't had the opportunity to go to a place like New York City, haven't had the opportunity to talk to people like Denzel Washington and Daniel Radcliffe, and to see a play like Hamilton on Broadway, and to have the cast, Lin-Manuel and Chris Jackson, come and speak to them, or to see The Color Purple, or to share time and touch Jennifer Hudson, so that they know dreams can really happen. It's not just us running our mouths saying, oh, these things a possibility. So when they look at us, when they look at a Roland Martin, they say, oh, that can happen to me. Where's Roland Martin from? You know, he's from where? Texas, Alabama, wherever he's from, but look where he is. They look at a Kenny Leon. I grew up on Miccosukee Road, and I went from Miccosukee Road to Broadway. How did that happen? Yes, it's more challenging for us. It's difficult. But that's also could be the joy of it. How do we get there? How do we succeed in the face of obstacles? And for African-American young people, it's always been, and what I want to teach them is that it's always been difficult for black people in America. But that doesn't mean that you cannot succeed and achieve your dreams. So the August Wilson Monologue Competition, which started in one city, in one school in Atlanta, Georgia, after August Wilson passed. And it was selfishly my way of saying, how do you keep August, how do you keep my friend, this great artist who had won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, how do you keep him alive? And the way you keep him alive is you put his script in the books, hands of young people. And so they keep it alive. So it started out as something selfish, and now it's grown from that one school, and now we're in 12 cities, 12 different states, where we fly the finalists from all the cities into New York City for one glorious weekend on his birthday. So they see 2-3 Broadway shows. They compete on a Broadway stage at the August Wilson Theater on Broadway. And when they leave that weekend, after that weekend, I call them Wilsonian soldiers, and they go off into the world knowing that they can really do whatever they want. If they want to be bankers, lawyers, doctors, television personalities, all you got to do is devise a plan and a program and a way to get there. And they look at all the adults around them who are cheering them on, and they know that it's possible. If they did what they do, I can do what's in my head. So that's what the monologue competition is really about. And at True Colors, we take that on. We say we're a regional partner, but we are the company that provides opportunity for all of the kids in all these states. And it's a work of love, you know, and I'm fortunate to have a great staff that understands that, and we work very hard. So yeah, we play golf, we have fun, we come out here and we dance, but it's really all about giving these kids the opportunity. And if they understand the possibilities and what they're able to accomplish, if they really understand that, then the country is better for it. The country is richer. The country is more loving because we have more caring young people that grow into more caring adults.
No!
Nice putt. Very nice.
That's how you putt, Chris. You better ask somebody. I want to thank Mo, Carmen, and Chris Metz for being on the show today. Thank you so very much. If you ain't got skills, call somebody. I'll see y'all tomorrow. Holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.